We are diving deep into a truly fundamental shift in military thinking. I mean, a shift from one of the world's major powers, China.
Right.
When we think about warfare, you know, our minds immediately go to troops, tanks, bombs, all that physical destruction.
A conventional picture, yeah.
Exactly. But the core insight we're exploring today is that for Beijing, victory might not require annihilation anymore. It's about the controlled management of disorder.
That is the absolute crux of it. This isn't just an evolution strategy. It's a new doctrine formalized by Chinese military strategists as dissipative warfare. Or Hao Sunzan.
Dissipative warfare.
And what makes it so unique is that it steps outside traditional military theory. It actually draws its foundation from physics, specifically thermodynamics and systems theory.
So wait, we're talking physics class concepts applied to global strategy, like the study of heat, energy, and entropy.
Absolutely. If you connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
it means framing conflict not as a fight over territory, but as a contest over entropy.
Entropy, the tendency toward disorder.
Exactly. The natural chaos within any complex system.
Right.
Whether that's a computer network, a national economy, or even a political coalition.
That immediately changes the goal. So instead of trying to, say, capture a hill or sink a ship,
right,
the goal is to make the opponent system become disorganized, unstable, and ultimately, you know, unable to function, all while making sure your own system stays coherent.
It's a structural attack.
Yeah.
It's aimed at inducing systemic failure.
Mm.
Precisely. The goal is destabilization, not annihilation. It's a strategy for winning below the threshold of a hot war.
So our mission today is to really unpack this.
Yes. We'll look at the four strategic pillars that define dissipative warfare, and we'll use very specific real-world examples from Chinese actions against Australia, Japan, and Taiwan to show how this high-level theory actually plays out.
That's a fantastic framework. Let's start with pillar one. It seems a little counterintuitive for a strategy focused on chaos. It's called negative entropy infusion, the inside game.
Well, if entropy is disorder, negative entropy, and this is a concept they borrowed directly from physics, is the deliberate importation of order to increase your own resilience.
So get your own house in order first.
That's the fundamental rule. Before you destabilize your adversary, you must first reinforce your own system. You have to create an asymmetry of stability.
Okay, so how does this actually manifest for the PLA, the People's Liberation Army?
It means making these massive systemic investments to harden their command structures, their logistics, and crucially, their information networks against any kind of disruption. They're basically reducing their own internal volatility.
And this is where all that high-tech integration we hear about comes in. It's not just about better weapons, it's about better decision-making under stress.
It is entirely about decision advantage and control. The sources really zero in on these intelligentized command systems.
Meaning what, exactly?
It's about seamlessly integrating AI, big data, real-time analytics, across all domains. Think of it as trying to reduce your decision latency to almost zero, giving commanders a near-perfect real-time picture of everything.
And where have we seen this kind of internal order on display?
You see it in the scale and precision of their large-scale exercises. The Eastern Theater Command drills near Taiwan, for example. They aren't just invasion rehearsals.
They're a demonstration.
They're a demonstration of internal control. You're seeing highly synchronized, multi-domain maneuvers, rockets, air, sea, cyber, all choreographed by these advanced systems. It shows the world that the PLA can maintain control, even at enormous scale. That demonstration of order is pillar one in action.
That makes perfect sense. You become rock solid internally, and then you start looking for the cracks on the outside. Which brings us to pillar two, threshold recognition.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like the intelligence gathering phase, finding the exact weak spots.
It's the science of locating vulnerability. Dissipative warfare strategists, they don't really believe in brute force. They use data-driven modeling to find the precise inflection points in an adversary's system where stability starts to crack.
The tipping point.
The tipping point, where a little bit of effort yields maximum systemic pain. It's about finding the system's weakest structural beam, not trying to demolish the entire building.
The case of Australia seems to be a textbook example of this applied economically.
Absolutely. After Canberra called for that investigation into COVID-19's origins, Beijing launched a huge economic coercion campaign. But the really crucial part is what they didn't target.
Right.
They didn't hit crucial exports like iron ore, because China still needs that.
Yeah.
That would harm their own system.
Violating pillar one, self-inflicted disorder.
Exactly. So instead they chose things like wine, coal, barley, beef, sectors that are politically powerful in certain regions of Australia, but things China could easily get elsewhere.
So they maximize the political pain inside Australia without hurting their own supply chains.
That is pure threshold recognition. It's cold, it's calculated, it's about creating political turbulence.
And we saw this applied against Japan as well.
Japan is tested constantly. Beijing probes their operational and political thresholds. We saw it with, you know, repeated low-level military actions, like using Coast Guard helicopters to breach Japanese airspace near disputed islands.
Not enough to start a war.
Never enough to start a war. But just enough to test Tokyo's political tolerance. How fast do they react? Can they stay composed? They also targeted Japanese seafood and tourism after certain diplomatic moves, knowing how important those sectors are culturally.
So once you find the crack with threshold recognition, you push it until it creates a fundamental shift. That sounds like pillar three, phase transition activation. This sounds like the most dangerous part.
It's the most complex, and your analogy about water boiling or freezing is spot on. You're trying to push the entire environment from one state of equilibrium to a new, fundamentally unstable one.
And the key is that it's done through cumulative actions, not one big strike.
Exactly. It's incremental. This forces the opponent to permanently operate under a new, much less comfortable strategic baseline.
Where can we see this kind of systemic transition happening right now?
The quintessential example is the militarization of the South China Sea. Think about the timeline. It started with just, you know, dredging sand, building artificial islands, then came the radar systems, then airstrips, then missile platforms.
But no single action was a red line moment.
Right. No single action was enough to trigger a massive U.S. response. But the accumulation of all those actions completely altered the strategic reality. It forced ASEAN states and the U.S. to recalibrate their entire maritime strategy. They had to accept a new baseline where China is permanently embedded there.
That's a massive strategic objective achieved without a major battle.
That is the phase transition. And the sources mention this playing out against Japan, too, near the Senkaku Island. Chinese maritime forces have just normalized a much higher level of presence there. Their patrols are now routine and persistent. The source material notes that Tokyo now operates under a state of conditional stability.
Meaning they're always on edge.
Always. They have to constantly divert resources just to maintain a status quo that's actually worse than it was before. They're permanently constrained.
This just sounds exhausting for the target. Which I guess brings us to pillar four, the management of all this instability. Advantage control.
This is the critical feedback loop. Once you introduce disorder, the job isn't done. It shifts to real-time calibration. You constantly monitor the adversary's reaction, public opinion, economic indicators, alliance cohesion, and you adjust your pressure points to keep that disorder going.
So it's not fire and forget. It's constant tweaking. How do they manage that, say, against Taiwan?
The primary tool there is cognitive warfare. It's a constant barrage of disinformation, cyber intrusions, psychological operations. Mm. But crucially, these aren't static campaigns.
They're adaptive.
They're calibrated daily based on shifts in Taiwanese sentiment or electoral dynamics. If one message causes too much backlash, they modulate. They shift the target. It's a nonstop pressure campaign designed to narrow Taipei's decision space.
And against Japan, it would be managing those economic and military levers we talked about.
Precisely. If the U.S. and Japan announce some new military coordination, Beijing might respond by, say, temporarily restricting tourism or food imports. It's a pressure point that's easily dialed up or down.
Which forces Tokyo to deal with domestic issues and makes the public question the cost of their foreign policy.
It keeps them strategically defensive.
What stands out here is how completely integrated this all is. This is not just a military playbook.
No, it's described in the sources as a civilizational strategy. It's the full fusion of economic, informational, diplomatic, and military tools into one unified architecture. Leverage and dependence are seen as weapons.
Is there a flagship example of that fusion on a global scale?
I mean, look no further than the Belt and Road Initiative and the Digital Silk Road. These aren't just trade initiatives. By building critical infrastructure ports, 5G networks, data centers, China embeds itself into the physical and digital systems of other countries.
Creating dependencies.
Huge leverageable dependencies. So if a partner nation opposes China on something, Beijing now has all these non-military off-ramps, economic, digital, to create immediate entropic pressure. It makes that nation's system vulnerable to the four pillars.
So how does this stack up against older models like attrition or even hybrid warfare? What's the so what here for the listener?
Well, the source comparison data makes it pretty stark. Traditional attrition warfare is about physical destruction. The goal is enemy annihilation. It's a wartime concept.
And hybrid warfare?
Hybrid warfare blends tactics for tactical disruption. It's often episodic for a specific conflict. Dissipative warfare is a strategic leap beyond both.
Because its core mechanism is?
Continuous large-scale entropy manipulation. The goal is systemic destabilization, and it operates across the entire peace-to-war spectrum. It's about achieving permanent political change through controlled chaos.
So if Japan has been a sort of test case for these pillars,
then Taiwan is clearly the ultimate theater.
Right. And Taiwan is a huge challenge because of its porcupine strategy.
Exactly. It's a defense posture built on dispersed, resilient assets designed to make a kinetic invasion just prohibitively costly. A conventional war is simply too high risk.
So the dissipative counter has to bypass those hard kinetic defenses?
It has to. So it targets the softer aspects, the deep seams of the Taiwanese system, psychological fatigue and political polarization. It aims to erode the island's confidence and cohesion without ever launching that costly invasion.
The goal is to make unification seem less scary than just continued exhausting instability.
That's the end game. And we saw this right after the recent presidential inauguration. The joint SOAR 2024A and B encirclement drills were explicitly framed as punishment.
They're a fusion of things. Military signaling, intimidation.
And an economic blockade rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
All designed to force Taiwan and its allies to react, to expend resources, to sustain that entropy.
And how does that psychological element really work day to day?
By constantly probing vulnerabilities, the shipping choke points, the pressure on their vital semiconductor exports, the manipulation of information to deepen political fractures inside Taiwan. The aim is to achieve a phase transition where continuous military encirclement and ADIZ intrusions don't feel like emergencies anymore.
They feel routine.
They feel routine. And that routine erosion shifts Taiwan from a state of political confidence to one of strategic apprehension.
The sources also note the historical undercurrent here.
This is critical. It's the emotional substrate. The doctrine leverages China's narrative of Taiwan as a lost part of the nation, historical grievances against Japan. It connects these strategic moves to deep, unhealed memories, which gives the erosion of political legitimacy an emotional resonance.
So for the U.S. and its allies, who are built on these complex, open, inherently messy democratic systems, how do you even counter a strategy that's designed to exploit that very messiness?
The sources outline three critical imperatives. First, systemic resilience. This means strengthening your institutions, diversifying supply chains so they aren't leverageable, and urgently hardening cognitive defenses against disinformation.
So if the enemy is injecting disorder, you build better filters and shock absorbers.
Exactly. Second, you need entropy monitoring. Targets need tools to detect and measure systemic disorder in real time. You need metrics for when your political cohesion or economic confidence is destabilizing.
And the third?
Strategic fusion. Responses have to mirror the threat. You have to integrate allied economic, informational, and military instruments into a coherent framework.
And it seems like that recognition is finally starting to penetrate in the West.
It is. The establishment of things like the China Mission Center shows an understanding that the challenge isn't just about kinetic war anymore. It's about strategic system management.
Ultimately, the core insight for us to take away is that dissipative warfare isn't about a quick, decisive blow. It's about a slow, calculated erosion of confidence, of cohesion, of control.
It really forces us to redefine what victory and defeat even look like in the 21st century.
Which brings us to our final thought for you to take with you. We've examined how dissipative warfare targets the deep, unhealed memory of conflict between China and Japan and China's emotional narrative about Taiwan. If this doctrine aims to destabilize any complex system by leveraging political and historical fault lines, what underlying domestic divisions, historical grievances, or political polarities in Western democracies might provide the next fertile ground for advantage control and strategic chaos in the coming decade? We leave you with that question to explore.